very confused about the company because those antennas, HF antennas, where they said the radio included was just some rod sticking out. And why do I have to now go to, like you suggest, bury so many radios that are a quarter wavelength? Really, what is the difference? Do I have to go through all this? I mean, I get this radio thing over and over again. They're very confused about, you know, all these antennas that they're advertising vertical that say no radio, no additional radio needed. Most of them just have a couple of little appendages sticking off the pipe take over.
Okay. There's at least two classes of radios that we should be discussing, in my opinion, Mel. In the case of a VHF antenna, a 2-meter or a 440 or a 1296, a station master-like thing, a vertical ground plane, that hopefully you're mounting 10 to 100 feet above the ground. If it's mounted on a chimney, it's typically 30 feet above the ground. That kind of an antenna on, let's say, 2 meters, which is now, 5 wavelengths or more above the ground, the 3 little rods that come out of that thing are more than adequate because it's trying to act as a counterpoise. In other words, in order for you to, from your transmission line, which is acting like the transmitter is right at the end of the transmission line. If your transmission line is doing its job, it acts like you've got a miniature transmitter mounted right at the antenna connector. And that transmitter is a pump. That's all it is. It pumps electrons. It has to draw electrons out of one pool of water, and squirt them into another. You're trying to launch the electrons into the thing that you call antenna, but you've got to take them from somewhere, and the thing you're taking them from is called the counterpoise. And in the case of an antenna with 3 little rods sticking out that are each a quarter wavelength long, that's more than enough. You could actually get away with one in the extreme case. That's exactly what you do with a vertical dipole. The vertical dipole, you've got this quarter wave rod sticking straight up. You've got another quarter wave rod sticking straight down. It's a thoroughly balanced antenna. The lower rod is the counterpoise for the upper rod. You pump some electrons on the first half cycle out of the lower half of the dipole and pump them into the upper half. On the next half cycle, you do the reverse. And you're bouncing those electrons back and forth, launching that wave. Well, those little radios on a VHF antenna mounted far above the ground, more than adequate. If they were inadequate, you'd launch a little bit of current on the outside of the coax cable coming down. Big deal. Nothing bad happens. However, let me drop. When you're now taking an HF antenna, 80 to 10 meter type thing, mounting it right on the lawn, very different situation. Now you're trying to make that lawn look like a sheet of copper, because the real antenna is the one that's sticking above the ground. That's the thing that you see. The mirror image of that has got to be the one that's below the ground. Well, you only have the mirror image if there's enough copper down there so that the RF wave thinks that there's a mirror there. And the spacing between the rods, you'd like them to be a small fraction of a wavelength so that it looks like a steady piece of screening, so to speak, a solid-state piece of screening. Now, many a manufacturer will tell you that, hey, we've included in the kit these 3 or 4 radials that you lay down. And because the average amateur can only measure standing wave ratio, he cannot measure antenna efficiency. He measures the standing wave ratio. It's beautiful. He gets on the air. He starts talking to people. He doesn't know that the antenna is running at 50% efficiency. Where's the other half of the power going? It's heating up the dirt because the RF is getting to the dirt because there isn't enough ground plane radials. Your next question is going to be, why in the world didn't the manufacturer of the antenna tell me that if I want high efficiency, I have to lay down 30 radials? And there's 2 reasons why he didn't do that. Number one, if he gave you the radials, the antenna would be expensive and he wouldn't be able to sell it. You would buy some other brand name. Number two, if he told you that you have to supply the extra radials, you're going to say, gee, that's an awful lot of work. I don't want to buy that antenna. I'll put up a dipole. If he told you the truth, it's either going to cost him money or it's going to cost you a lot of elbow grease. Therefore, he keeps it as a secret if he knows, and if the guy isn't intelligent enough, he may not even know that his antenna that he's selling is running at 40 or 50% efficiency, and the rest of it's heating up the ground, and the worms are happy in the wintertime. If you're a really serious amateur, like KQKEY, who has a ground plane antenna in his front yard, he's laid down something like 32 radials, because he wants efficiency. he would have gotten away with four, and the signal would be more like 50% efficient, which is half an S unit down. It doesn't mean he's off the air. It just means he's going to have a lot more trouble getting to that DX station because he thinks he's radiating 100 watts, but only 50 watts is getting into the air. The rest of it's going into his lawn. That's the way I see it, Mel. You've spent a lot more time than I have on HF, and tell me your take on the proper number of radios. You've been there, you've done it, and lucky for you, somebody dug up the street in front of your house and you had the ability to do this. K2KEY, K2RIW in the tech head.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, I happen to be fortunate that this thing, you know, situation with the radio fell right into my lap because there's no way possible that I would ever contemplate putting down 100 radios before, unless I had the cooperation of the city of New York, literally, was ripping out everything. Of course, it was just there for laying out and kicking dirt over it, and they did the rest of the street, sidewalks, and everything on top of it. But this question has arisen so many times, and the question is, because there's a number of these antennas that they have revolutionary effect. I won't mention names, but there's a revolutionary new antenna technology. And this is an HF vertical that goes from through 10 meters, and it says they go through a whole rigmarole, and basically what they've got is their counterpoint is a couple of 48-inch rods, four of them, sticking off the bottom of this beautiful pipe, polished piece of metal, and a wire stretched around it, and they're giving all kinds of claims here that they found 4,000 feet of wire risk for 60 radios and had the Luciferium, the Earth force, drop from 30 to 4 ohms. All that effort and the radiate power would only increase, now would only be 50 watts out of the 100 watt grid. Half of it is still warming the ground. So they said, obviously, a new vertical design is needed. They have vertical design. So these things are very confusing. This is constantly coming up, Dick, and it's hard to lay it to rest over.
Studio, Dick. I'm going to make a guess as to what Rich is about to say. There is one breakthrough that has occurred a zillion years ago, and we're hearing about it now, and that is when you feed a quarter wave or five-eighths wave, a quarter wave in particular, ground plane antenna. That means the actual thing you call antenna is a quarter wavelength long, and the rest of it is a bunch of ground plane radios. You have maximum current at the point that you feed it. Its impedance really at that point is something in the vicinity of 30 ohms. And you would like the ground plane radio system to not only look like 1 ohm RF-wise, but to also simultaneously have so little space between the ground plane radios that the RF energy doesn't get a chance to peak between those radios and see that lossy dirt. That's what happens with quarter waves. When you go to the radiator being electronically half-wave long, and you can do that with loading coils and top hat capacitors and really making it longer or whatever, but if one means or another, you make the radiator a half-wave long instead of a quarter-wave long, now the impedance at the end that you feed is more like 2,000 ohms. Now you can make a half-wave resonant antenna and mount it on the railing at the balcony of your apartment, and it'll work like a charm. And there's no apparent ground plane radios there at all. You can get away with murder with half-wave. So half-wave antennas make a huge improvement in this area, and you don't have to lay down anywhere near as many radios to get full performance. But if you've got a tall enough tree in the backyard, and many of us do on 40 meters and certainly on 20 meters, where you could hang a pure vertical dipole balanced antenna, mechanically how you get the feed line to it could be a little bit troublesome. There's ways you can feed it at the bottom, and with a little more difficulty, there's ways you can feed it in the middle. But as long as you can solve the mechanical problem of getting the feed line to this vertical half-wave dipole, all of that problem goes away. You've got a lot more altitude for the antenna. You've got the world's best counterpoise, which is an exact symmetric other half of the dipole. I'm amazed at that antenna, and I think it's because of mechanical reasons, hasn't become a hell of a lot more popular. The few people that have put up a pure vertical dipole will sing the praise of that thing to the sky. Let's see what Richard's got to say about all this. N2EO, K2LIW, and TechNet. Make sure you wait for the beep. I did.
K2QIQ.
Glad to recognize Rich first.
Okay, Dick, yeah, I'm echoing what you were going to say. No brand, I'm not going to mention a brand, but I have a half-wave, an electrical half-wave vertical, covers 6 through 40 meters, uses 7 48-inch counterpoise radios, works fine. Yeah, Dick.
Rich, you and I are not selling antennas. We get no benefit out of this. Go ahead and tell us the brand name and the price if you want to. We're allowed to mention brand names on here. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, it's a Cushcraft R8. Kind of expensive, about $400-something. I've had it up now, about 6 or 7 years. It's 12 feet off the ground on a piece of water pipe. And, I'm putting up the quad, but I got to tell you, it really works well. Put it the other way, I was so pleased with it after I put it up, that I was worried that Cushcraft might discontinue it, so I bought a second one that's sitting in my attic in an unopened box. Yeah, Vic.
Wow, is that a testimonial? Oh, man. You're obviously happy with that antenna. Glenn, tell us your take on all this. K2LIW.
Well, unfortunately, my take of that led me to another question. I understand counterpoise issues with the quarter wave antenna, and going to the half wave antenna, now you have balance. Counterpoise is again defined above ground, and that takes care of that issue. I guess my next question now is, we have other multiple wavelength antennas, the antennas that are fractions of wavelengths larger than half wave, like the 3/4, the 5/8, and the 7/8. What actually happens to the counterpoise at, let's say, like a 5/8 wave antenna? Is it the same principle as the half wave, or do we have a lack of symmetry again?
I think it's a law of diminishing return. If I plot the resistance component of impedance versus length of a radiating antenna, when I start off with the antenna a small fraction of a wavelength long, the resistive component of radiation is about an ohm or two, and the reactive component is many thousands of ohms capacitive. I start making the antenna longer and longer, and I'm always impedance matching it with a good antenna tuner, an ideal antenna tuner. By the time I get an antenna that is quarter wavelength long, operating above a perfect ground plane, I'm at the 35 ohm resistive component, and the reactance goes to zero. It's a resonant antenna, quarter wave long electronically, which is about 95% of that mechanically, above a perfect great big sheet of copper on a VHF frequency, 35 ohms. As I start making that go toward half wave, my resistive component of impedance starts going to something like 2,000 ohms, highly dependent on what is the diameter of the radiator in wavelength. And Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, on the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th edition, has a beautiful graph that shows you this, and that is empirical data measured by a real engineer that put thousands of man hours, or at least hundreds of man hours, into all of those measurements. Okay, one graph is the resistive component. Let me drop. The other graph is the reactive component. Chapter 4 of 2nd, 3rd, and 4th edition of Antenna Engineering Handbook. Jasek in the beginning, Jasek and Johnson later, and then Gowalik. I can't think of the name of the guy for the 4th edition. The 1st edition, those graphs are in Chapter 3, not Chapter 4. They added another chapter around there in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th edition. So there you know what the resistive component is. If the resistive component in ohms of the radiation resistance of the antenna is large compared to the equivalent size of your ground plane radial system, it will work like a charm. As you start going to 5/8 waves, now the antenna starts becoming inductive in reactance, and the resistance starts coming back down. When you get to full wavelength, let me think about this now, half wave, quarter wave, low impedance, half wave, high impedance, 3/4 wave, low impedance again. At 3/4 wave, 5/8 wave is halfway between, not quite halfway, between half wave and 3/4. You're starting to come back down in resistance again, and the ground plane radios are going to start coming back into more influence on the efficiency of the antenna, but not as much. A 5/8 wave has a slightly higher phase center of radiation. You could say the radiation appears to be happening more at the current maximum point. And now, for the 5/8 wave, that point is moved above the ground plane. So that current maximum point, which is making the strongest magnetic field, which is part of the mechanism that couples it to your ground and heats up the earth, that being farther above the ground means the ground plane radio system is not as important at 5/8 wave as it would be at 1/4 wave, but it's still more important than it would be at half wave. So if you look at that curve and look at the number of ohms of radiation resistance, you can make a pretty close gut feel for how important the integrity of the ground plane radio system is if the antenna is mounted close to Earth. You can have a mediocre set of radials, like only one single radial, if the antenna is mounted far enough above the ground. You and I would call that a full half-wave dipole that's vertically set up mechanically, if you know what I mean. What if that makes some sense, Glenn? KQLIW.
Yeah, absolutely, it does, Dick, and a lot of times it's not all that straightforward, and it's a lot of times a safe way to play is with the half wave. You get a lot of bang for the buck with that, and a lot of symmetry, and it seems to work pretty well, and bandwidth is pretty decent. But there again, you know, just the question, sometimes you go back to the mobile installation, and we're going to have to sheet metal on the roof of the vehicle, and use a 5/8 wave antenna, and that kind of explains a lot of times where, you know, a lot of these installations with 5/8 wave antennas aren't as good the performance of sometimes others with half-wave antennas and the like from car to car. It's almost an application sensitive kind of problem. Back to that kind of thing.
Yeah, there's one way that they can do the impedance matching at the base of a 5/8 wave mag mount on your car, which in order to do the impedance matching, the whip itself you're looking at is 5/8 of a wave long, multiplied by 0.95% because of the capacitive loading effect on the end. And the loading mechanism, the impedance matching mechanism they put in the base, is electronically bringing it up to 3/4 wave, because that's where it comes back to having no reactance. So the integrity of the magnetic coupling network, your mag mount, the way it couples into the car, and you are launching some current into the car, obvious by the fact that most automobile-mounted VHF antennas tend to fire in the direction of the maximum mass of the vehicle. In other words, if I mounted the antenna on the rear left-hand side of the car, rear left-hand corner, and I now put the car in a parking lot and do circles and measure signal strength of my favorite repeater, I'll find out that I'm getting the strongest signal toward the front right side of the car when the antenna is on the rear left side of the car. So if at all possible, it sure would be nice to put the antenna right dead center in the middle of the roof on the assumption the car has a metal roof. If your car has got a fiberglass roof or it's a convertible, life gets a lot more tough. I've on occasion, when I'm moving some heavy stuff on my car, have mounted the mag mount, because I want to talk to somebody while I'm doing it, I've mounted the mag mount on the hood of the car in front of the windshield. And I was transmitting 150 watts at the time. So I'm looking through the windshield, I'm looking at this antenna, it's a couple of feet in front of me, and I'm radiating 150 or 180 watts into it. I'm probably paranoid, but I made the transmission brief. Back to you, Glenn, you might want to make a comment on all of that. QIQ, KQLIW.
Yeah, very good point made, Dick. It's always something that's always interesting, especially with the mobile applications. As a matter of fact, I had one installation where it's a screwdriver antenna that tunes for all the low bands, which is really just a fraction of the wavelength on the whip, where it's basically tuned by a motor-driven coil on the back, and it's extremely sensitive to the front end of the vehicle. As a matter of fact, it's like I'm doing DXing from the mobile, that I drive down to Jones' parking lot, I can almost point the vehicle because whereas the antenna is mounted, it's mounted on the rear half of the car on a hitch mount in the back. So when I basically point, whatever direction I point the vehicle at, it's almost like a beam. Not exactly, but certainly I almost point the vehicle in the direction that I want to propagate. Back to you, KQ.
That experience is a very strong example of the fact that you're launching current into the sheet metal of the car. And so the antenna itself is a pure vertical device which should be omnidirectional. But because you're getting these strong directional characteristics, it's obviously launching current into the car. And now I'm going to make a guess that 75% of the radiation is from your antenna and the other 25% is from the car. I bet you've seen things like that because you've got a mobile mount on your car, Rimmel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
And it says K2KEY. Well, I have my, you might have an old classic car that I have my mobile equipment. I don't have the other car yet, my old car off of it. But I have up on the upper deck of my Chevy, I have the Tronic Hustle lip. So it's, you know, elevated. It's not on a bumper mount. And in all comparisons that I've made with other people with mobiles and so-called shootouts, this system that I'm using always seems to come out as the best mobile signal. So that's why I guess I'm just not convinced that a vertical antenna, like Rich said, and I've made some comparisons wherever I could, wherever I was able to borrow any vertical antenna. And I'm going to tell you the truth, Dick. For instance, we'll take 40 meters using my, basically my 40-meter dipole, vertical dipole that's not quite vertical, I guess say, makes about 28-degree angle with ground, seems to always outshine any of those antennas. And I don't want to mention the name of it, but Rich did mention one name, and I was able also to try another one. And I can't see how they are achieving that counterpoint with those rods at all. Let's see, this pole was a lot taller than that, especially for 40 meters. You're looking at something like about 66 feet for 40 meters over.
A 40 or an 80 or 160 meter antenna on an automobile is a tough installation by my standards. The so-called counterpoise there is this little blob of metal that you and I call automobile that wavelength-wise is very small at those low frequencies. Therefore, the majority of your counterpoise of that antenna is dependent on the quality of the soil that you're driving over. Guarantee your antenna will tune differently and your efficiency will be very different if you're driving over dry desert soil or if you're driving over a swamp. And which is better, I'm not sure. The swamp might be better. And the stuff that we drive that's in between, I mean, the swamp is highly conductive. That can be good. The desert is highly resistive. It's almost a pure dielectric. There's no conductivity. There's no moisture. And therefore, it's got no mechanism for loss. So, highly conductive has no loss. Highly capacitive has no loss. And it's the ordinary dirt in between that most of us have that's capable of a lot of loss. And very few of us measure efficiency of the antenna. On top of that, I think the pattern is going to be a little bit different when you're driving over desert soil versus swampland. Your elevation angle of radiation is going to be different, in my opinion. So you think you're connecting it to a great big chunk of metal. By my eye, it looks like a big chunk of metal in my car. Radio-wise, it's an extremely small, wavelength-wide chunk of metal, and therefore the capacitance of that vehicle to the earth underneath is the other half of the counterpoise system, I think. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Let's get back to at home here, where I have 55 foot vertical for 18 for my low band CX, and with 100 radio very. Did I go through all this trouble for nothing that I could achieve safe? How would I say this? Not the right word. Did I achieve the same result? Okay, achieve the same result by using one of these verticals, such as Rich Perkins, that uses a much shorter pole and has just a couple of rods sticking out. In other words, side by side, am I going to say, gee, I really put a lot of effort into something that was not necessary, Dick? Or do you think that I have a more efficient radiator or a more efficient low angle radiator, I should say, because that's basically what I was looking for, by having basically a full size situation, a classic vertical that stands 65 feet and has 100 radios, or did I, was this a really an overkill that's over?
It's a Leo thing. Rich recognized, I don't think it's an overkill. There's a chance that you put up a lot more hardware, but you would come out ahead for two reasons. Not only do you have a very substantial ground plane radio system that almost makes that signal think that you're ground around that antenna as a pure sheet of copper, properly laid out, 100 radios will do that, makes it look like a pure sheet of copper. In other words, it's like window screening, where the holes in the window screening are so small, so to speak, that the RF can't get through those holes. The wavelength, a 20-meter wavelength, or an 80-meter wavelength, that's 3/8 to 24, 250 foot is the wavelength. It can't see the holes between those radials. It thinks it's continuous. And because yours is 66 feet high, your center of radiation might be higher up above the ground than Richard's. The guys who set up broadcast antennas talk about something which I think they call it ground gain, elevation gain or whatever. In other words, where is the center of radiation of the antenna? A taller antenna with normal methods of feeding it is further above the ground, and that gives you a little more clearance of the local trees, the local houses, all the stuff around that's less than ideal to propagate through. You might come out ahead. The advantage that Rich has is he hasn't made this great big investment in ground plane radials and a whole lot of hardware, but for his amount of effort and dollars, he's getting more bang for the dollar. He may be not getting quite as big a bang as you. That's a pure guess on my part. Until you guys do a side-by-side shootout under ideal conditions, it's not going to be perfectly easy to tell. There's a lot more variables here than meet the eye. What else is new? N2EO, K2RIW in the deck net. No, the Kirchgraf feet does not cover 75 or 80 meters. It goes down to 6 meters, down to 40 meters. I checked it against, for instance, my 80-meter dipole inverted thing. All right. My 80-meter dipole inverted beam fed with open wire line, I've compared it on 40 meters to the R8. And they run neck and neck. But the antenna does not go down to 75. It's, you know, I guess they could have done it, but it's about 30, what is it now? I think it's about 30-something feet tall. It's an electrical half-wave. They do it with a combination of trap and sub-stick. Back to that N2EO.
Now, some of what we're talking about is a little bit academic. If I had an antenna that was 95% efficient, I put 100 watts into it, and 95 of those watts get radiated into space at some desirable angle of elevation that hits the ionosphere just right, and I talk to my buddy in London, and I have a nice QSO with him. That's a pretty ideal situation. Now I start degrading that antenna. I start yanking out those ground plane radials. I mount it closer to the ground. I use a slightly lossy antenna tuner. And so now I go from 95% efficiency down to 50% efficiency. The average aperture, and I use a lossier piece of feed line. My first step is I go down to 50% efficiency because I've yanked out a whole lot of the ground plane radials. What will my guy in London see? 3 dB down is half an S unit if his S meter is well calibrated. If the signal was marginal to begin with, I'd just jump below his noise and he doesn't talk to me. But if it was a real good day and I'm talking to him at S8 and his local noise is S7, his local noise is S3, and I was at S8, and I make these changes, and I go down to S7.5, he's going to say, you're not moving my S meter as much, but you sound good. I then go the next step, and I plug in a lossier feed line, and I get another 3 dB of loss, a total of 6, and I come down a whole S unit. I used to be S8, and now I'm S7. On a good day, he's going to hear me. On a bad day, in a pileup, they ain't going to hear me. So, a guy could lose a whole lot of sleep over the fact that his antenna is running at 50 or 25% efficiency. That's not a showstopper. Because the signal strength the guy gets on the other end is related logarithmically. Your S meter is a log function. Every time you half the voltage he gets, that's one S unit, 6 dB down. But that's a 25% efficiency ever went down one S unit by the changes I made. You talk to the average guy and you say, I'm going from 95% efficiency down to 25% efficiency, he would say, why do you bother? The guy who doesn't know because he followed the instructions, let me drop. He followed the instructions on his particular brand of ground plane radio antenna, which only has it put in 4 ground plane radios, and maybe it ran with his lousy feed line and lousy ground plane system. He ran 25% efficiency. He made lots of QSOs. He didn't know he was running 25% efficiency. He didn't know he was one S unit down from what he could have been. So the guy who is a good scientist and really wants to know how things are working is going to worry about this. Another kind of ham radio operator who doesn't want to get 330 contacts on his DXCC list. He's not quite that competitive. That's not his goal. He'll talk to the guys who hear him, and he'll have a nice ride shoe. He'll talk to that guy in Germany, and he'll have a good meeting of the mind. He'll ask the guy in Germany, hey, I've never lived in Germany. I'm kind of curious what it's like. When you walk out your front door in the morning, when you're going to work, as you open up the front door, tell me what you see. And if the guy in Germany understands his language real well, the two of them can have a beautiful QSO and really enjoy it and learn each other's culture and not worry about the exact amount of S-meter deflection they're getting. So there's many ways of looking at the whole situation. Don't kill your grandmother for that last 25% efficiency. K2KUY. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Case, this is K2KUY. All right, well, I can go on and on and on about, antenna efficiency, what, where, and how. And, I have checked a number of verticals that I was able to borrow, and not going to go out and go to purchase them, but whatever I was able to borrow in the past. Compared them, I used that 40 meters. Using just that 40 meter dipole with some chunk of wire hanging from the 66 foot and coming down to the ground at 28 degrees, I have not found any of these verticals that, well, let's put it this way, did better. They all either fell in approximately the same zone or in a number of cases. The dipole did a lot better, or I could say sufficiently better to stand there and say, gee, it's hard to imagine a piece of wire here, a couple dollars worth of wire versus hundreds of dollars worth of beautiful shiny pipe. So I could say there's a lot more to it than that meets the eye, and not to give up on any of them. Depends on, I would say, what your personal situation is, location, whatnot. All right, shall we go on to the next one, Dick?
Yep, I think we've done enough radio for tonight, but I know it's not a closed issue. I know we're going to hear more about it, and there's more to the story. What else is new? Oh, you were up, Mel.
Roger, I don't want to get into the ground screen situation that I also laid down here, but that'll start another whole, a whole debate. Let's see, we have some more antennas. Okay, here's one. Because of my situation, I can manage to put up at least 66 feet of wire, okay? 65 feet of wire, which I'd like to use on 40 meters, but I can only feed it because of my situation on an end. I understand there is an antenna that was very popular, that NZ that works quite well. Can you tell me something about, well, I think what they're alluding to, new amateur, basically, because still doing amateur radio, and just got my license, I want to get on HF, and he's like, okay, blah, blah, you know, 40 meters, yes, 40 meters band of choice right now, especially. So, what do you call, you know, how do you go about this? I think trying to more or less talk about a Zep antenna, and then go up, go ahead.
M10 Zep with a tuna, 40 to 10.
And that's surprising. That in the case of 40 meters with a 65-foot long piece of wire, it is a half wave long. You're feeding at the end, and the tip is where the voltage is maximum, and where the impedance is the highest. You're feeding something like 2,000 ohms of resistive component, and if it's the right length, there's no reactive component. There are people who have brought the coax cable up to some nice altitude where that antenna begins, and the antenna is now horizontal to the ground, and they feed the center conductor to that piece of wire, and the shield goes nowhere. And you could make another variation where the shield goes to whatever mast you're using. You could ground it to whatever is local, or you could put some ground plane radios on it. But I think the pure N-fed ZEP, in its pure form, just connects the center conductor to the antenna, and the shield goes nowhere. Because the antenna impedance is so high, 2,000 ohms, on a 50-ohm piece of cable, the amount of signal you feed back to the cable that goes down the outside of the cable is maybe only a few percent. Not ideal, but more than good enough. That's my recollection of what an N-fed ZEP is and the way it works. From your reading, do you remember an N-fed ZEP being similar to that? Mel, go ahead.
Dick, you're right, but it's not coax, open wireline.
Okay, and the only reason they use open wireline is because the impedance is so high there, 2,000 ohms, that the wire itself of the transmission line is running at a very high vis run. 2,000 ohms on a 50-ohm line is, what is it, a 40-to-1 standing wave ratio in the wire. So coax can be kind of lossy, and they use open wire line for two reasons. One, it runs 300 or 600 ohms, which is a lot closer to the 2,000 of the antenna. And second of all, because there's quite a bit of signal bouncing back and forth on the inside of the transmission line, and therefore it is capable of more loss. The higher impedance twin lead open wire line has not only less vis-run, but less loss besides. You cannot double your head. So, yeah, the N-fed ZEP is fed with open wire line. I'm glad you corrected me on that. I have seen people do it with coax. I think it's not recommended. It would work. Back to you, Ev. I bet you built some of these, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. In fact, that was my first antenna that I struck up, and I used 300-ohm wire, of course, 1950. It was a common wire that was available every television that had an antenna on the roof, of course, used 300-ohm wire. So that was available for literally nothing. And the classic ZEP antenna, I will describe it, if you are talking about a ZEP antenna for 40 meters, had a 66-foot horizontal or flat top, and it had 66 feet of 300-ohm wire feeders, and it went into a tuner that was basically high impedance. Tuner that had a coil, then it that went to ground and had a variable capacitor, of course, to the high Z point, and then had a coupling coil that was link coupled, and that went to the transmitter. I mean, that was the classic setup of the ZEP system of way back. In fact, I believe ZEP antenna, of course, came to be known because it was actually named after the Zeppelin. It was the antenna used on old airship Zeppelins that they trailed the long wire, the wire behind the Zeppelin. That was the communication antenna, if I'm not mistaken, to take over.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds right. Where the dirigible itself was, or the blimp, or what are you going to call it? The light of an airship, that was the counterpoise, and the ZEP just a trail behind it. Go ahead, Rich.
That's what I was going to comment. The gentleman who sent in that question could go either to the ARRL antenna book or just the ARRL handbook and look up that antenna, Zulu Echo Papa Papa, and it'll give a complete rundown on how to build it. Very cheap, 56 feet of wire and some open wire lines and a tuner, and he'll be able to work everything from 40 right up to 10 meters. And that's correct, they used them on the Zeppelins back in the 20s and 30s, so it got to be known as the Zepp antenna. Old technology, but still quite viable. Go ahead, Dick.
And I think Jack Harrick, earlier, KF2GV, trailing from his P. Baron, PE58-P/P aircraft, I think he was running an antenna that was essentially a Zepp antenna. What do you think, Mel?
Very possible. You know, I do remember a couple more words on Zepp. There was an antenna that was, again, go back to the 50s. The early version VHF and UHF, again, because of how we got on VHF and UHF, the surplus home rule, whatever, how we did it, I remember a version of it, and it was called the J antenna, which basically, I think, was a Zepp standing on 10 stick, vertically polarized Zepp antenna. I believe they referred to it in those days as the J antenna. Am I correct, over?
There, I'm not sure, but I can see how, once you make it vertical, any radiator that's a half wave long gives you an extremely high impedance. Therefore, what you use for the counterpoise becomes very unimportant. In some cases, you can almost ignore it. In the case of the ordinary Zepp antenna with open wire, you literally ignore the ground plane and get away with it. Back to you, Mel.
I guess so. I think that was, I almost can remember using that one on about 18 inches long on VHF back in my early days of, not going to get it now, so I think we discussed lecture wires and how we did VHF and UHF back in those days. That was part of my system. It was a very crude system using one of the lighthouse tubes to get me on the computers and all. So. Okay, very good. Talked about Zepp antennas. We have time, I think, maybe for one more, Dick. It's up to you. Go ahead.
Go for it, Mel.
So I was just going to ask one question. Did we neglect Paul for any reason tonight with anything to do with the space report over?
Paul told us that not much is going on until May when the landing of that Mars craft takes place. He says that he's looking forward to May when they land that Mars craft, and then there'll be a lot to talk about. Go ahead.
Okay, roger. All right, let's see what else I got here. All right. And then, just looking for, antenna questions. I'm not going to get into some of this other stuff here. Okay, here we go again. G5RV. Why do I have such strange results of my G5? I bought the G5RV, I better not mention. I don't think I should mention the company, but it's a fairly popular antenna company. And I noticed that I get very high, when I measure SWR, why do I get high SWRs on certain bands with the G5RV? And, I have one answer for that about what happened with G5RV, because the original version of G5RV, that area, says to me, the first, I get as high as on 3.6 megahertz, 8 meters, SWR 6.26, yet I will get, on 20 meters, I will get an SWR of 1.76. So on and so forth, varies, I don't know, dust down and everything like that, yet 10 meters, I get an SWR at 28.2 of 3.5. Can you tell me what is going on with the G5RV? I can tell you a few things what happened with 5RV is, things that they don't really tell you when you purchase it. It became a very popular antenna, but there was some controversies about what the changes were that I don't think the original designer really desired over.
Yeah, I think Lou Varney, who invented the G5RV, came up with a combination of feed lines and antenna, length of wire, and two different kinds of feed lines combined, which gave him a medium good impedance match on 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10. The biggest compromise was on 10. People who built the original G5RV, according to Lou Varney's instructions, the majority of them complained that the standing wave ratio is quite high on 10 meters, and that you can really only get away with it with a modern-day transmitter if you've got a pretty wide dynamic range antenna tuner. Now, as long as the feed line that you're using is low enough and long, a 3.6, anything shy of a 20 to 1 standing wave ratio on 80 meters is not bad, as long as you've got a low enough loss in the feed line commensurate for a 20 to 1 standing wave ratio. I had a trap dipole that I put up on as an inverted V on my tower a whole lot of years ago when I was a little bit more interested in HF. It had a 20 to 1 standing wave ratio. My particular transmitter was something equivalent to a DX100. It had a very large tuning range to its high output tuning network, a tube type transmitter. And I worked guys in South America with no problem. Worked like a charm. A perfectly matched dipole with perfectly matched 72-ohm twin leads from a perfectly matched 72-ohm antenna tuner, balanced output antenna tuner. There is zero standing wave ratio on that transmission line. But in the dipole itself, it's running 20 to 1 standing wave ratio. The energy is bouncing back and forth on the dipole itself, which you could say is a quarter inch away from the end of the transmission line. So don't lose a whole lot of sleep about standing wave ratio. Standing wave ratio, everyone believes that all the reflected energy is lost. It is not. 90-some-odd percentage is recovered as long as your antenna tuner has enough range. Yes, the signal is bouncing back and forth a number of times on the transmission line, but if the transmission line starts to have blown up and lost, that's not a problem. The only real disadvantage that's left with a high-vis-wire antenna is that as you QSY, as you tune up and down the band, you have to readjust the antenna tuner. And if you don't have the numbers written down, it's going to take you some time to re-derive the correct tuning and loading control numbers on the antenna tuner. And if you're smart enough to build a microprocessor in there that as you tune the frequency, the knobs move themselves automatically, you would never even know that it's a sharply tuned antenna that you have to readjust every time you change. So standing wave ratio itself is not a loss mechanism. It's an annoyance when it comes to
repeater, timeout.
It's an annoyance when it comes to the ease of use of the antenna, but it is not necessarily a loss mechanism. K2KE1, K2RIW.
Exactly, this is K2KEY. Let me say a few words first about the G5RV. As Vic says, Mr. Maloney more or less designed it. He set it with a 300 ohm wire line. And what happened was, to sell the antenna, I know who's marketing it, and you know, they marketed it as, I could say, an 8-10 meter antenna. And to get it to be more attractive, what they do, is, of course, they suck that one-to-one vallum from the ribbon line to a 50-ohm coaxial. And most likely, I could basically refer to as a current-type vallum. And the better way to have gone with a number of the people that did experiment, but of course, I guess the price is some other situation, that they were going to use a system that was suggested that would feed the coax directly to the 300 ohm line not to use that balun, but to use the current of balun, in other words, the ferrite beads, and put them along a stretch of the line that joins with a 300 ohm wire, in other words, joins the coax, then to stack a number of these beads. I think they said six ferrite beads that they would put along the line that would improve the match for the G5RB, and not to, you know, just use that single current balun, that one-to-one balun that they were supplying that has the connector on one end through your coax on the other two wires poking out of this potted unit that goes to the 300 ohm wire. So I know you're going to have this SI6 that's not so bad, you know, it's not so last thing, you know, thinkable that it will ruin the use of this antenna. You go through an APU and one of the antenna or any of the tuners, and you're sure you can manage the use of that antenna. Go ahead, Dick.
I agree with you. Turns out that the standing wave ratio itself, lots of people lose a lot of sleep over that. It in itself is not bad. Every antenna has, in the antenna structure itself, whether it's the probe inside the feed horn for a microwave antenna, whether it be the wire itself of your dipole, whether it be the wire itself of your loop antenna, whether it be the radiator system itself of your ground plane, every one of these radiating systems has internally, in the real radiator, a tremendously high standing wave ratio, minimum of 20 to 1, and some of the more compact antennas at 30 and 40 to 1 standing wave ratio in the antenna structure itself. But then somewhere there's an impedance matching device, which comes out to the feed line, and what you measure on the feed line is the standing wave ratio of that portion of the system. And yes, if the standing wave ratio is there, it's something you have to take into account. You have to make sure you've got an antenna tuner that has a large enough range. And every antenna tuner, if you plot where it covers, a Smith chart is a kind of a fancy chart that shows you every possible impedance you can get on a transmission line. And if you plot all of the area on your Smith chart where your antenna tuner is effective, it'll cover, I'm going to pick a number, 75% of the Smith chart, and it's a blob over on one corner of the Smith chart. It's not centered. So that if your antenna tuner runs out of range because your particular antenna has a high standing wave ratio, all you've got to do is add another length of cable to your transmission line. It will take that circle of your standing wave ratio on the Smith chart, and your dot of where you're operating now slides around on that circle to another spot, and if that new spot is inside of the active area that's covered by your antenna tuner, you're back in operation. So I bet you more than half the time, even if your antenna has a standing wave ratio that is so high that one of the knobs on your antenna tuner runs out of range, that's not the end of the story. But with a little more study, or just randomly try it, add another length of transmission line and try again, and you may be back into the active range. K2KGY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. Oh, no doubt. I can say it's a situation that don't get carried away. In fact, that's all I've gotten here. People making measurements and understanding measurements and very upset about some of the measurements that I guess in a way these handheld analyzers are great little gadgets and all, but sometimes I think we read a little too much into, you know, what the results are. So this was a question here that also was asked by a new ham that I'm so confused to, like, homebrew an antenna or do I buy one? Which do you think will be the best overall situation? And I get this over and over again, I guess. There's nothing wrong. I guess you can achieve just the same results with a homebrew antenna as you can with any of the commercially available ones. In fact, you can copy basically any of those wire antennas at a fraction of the cost what possibly they can give you that's going to give you such a difference in a wire antenna that it's going to be, you know, you're going to say, oh, well, gee, I should good thing it went out for this one antenna. Don't see any clear way that you're going to get a wire antenna commercially made that's going to outperform one that you homebrew, Dick. This is another question I had here. Which one should I buy? Whether I should buy a commercial one or a homebrew itself, over.
Hey, your push the talk button gave us a number of dropouts on that last transmission, though. The problem is a little bit similar to a guy who is interested in astronomy, and in the old days, half the people would grind their own mirror, and half of them would buy a telescope. And the answer is, what should you do? And the answer is partially, what do you think you'll get the most enjoyment out of? The process of properly walking around the barrel and going through this crazy grinding motion, which by some automatic process makes a parabolic shape of a mirror that you're grinding, and you can grind a much bigger mirror than you can afford to buy in many cases, and you learn a whole lot of other things that you might enjoy. But if your major motivation is astrophotography, you want to take pictures of stars and nebula and planets, and the actual method by which a telescope is built and how it works, you don't care about it, then write a check, buy a telescope, connect a camera, and enjoy it. And the same thing with ham radio. You could, if you want to, if you're a guy that's a rag chewer and you like talking to people in foreign lands, you could hire a man who's an antenna expert, you write a check, he decides on the antenna, he installs it for you, he takes the check, he walks away, you connect the rig to the antenna, and you're on the air, and you enjoy it. If you're a more, a guy with not as much resources, or if you're a guy who enjoys building with his own hands, seeing it work, and making modifications, build the antenna. What the average ham is going to do is both. It's just a matter of when he does each. He does both at different points of time. If he starts off as a pauper and he hasn't convinced the wife yet that, hey, this is a good hobby, I want to invest the money in it, and he invests $20 and he builds the antenna with his own hands, and it'll work almost as good as that $350 thing with all the shiny aluminum coils on it. And maybe the fancy antenna with the coils works on more bands than the one he home brews, although there's ways you can do that also with home brew. Ultimately, you're going to do both. He thinks he's deciding which to do. The answer really is, which one should I do first? And now he's got to decide what he gets the most enjoyment out of. If his enjoyment is out of operating and talking to people, and if he's got the money, buy it. If he wants to understand how the antenna works, he wants to get on the air and talk a little bit technical, talk to a guy who has also built an antenna that's a little bit different, and then compare notes. I built mine with 14-gauge wire. I built mine with 14-gauge wire, 18-gauge wire. I used butt repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel. I used closing buttons as an insulator so that nobody could see the wire. The other guy used great big egg insulators, and he's pouring a kilowatt into it. I mean, there's all kinds of ways you can compare notes between you and your friend who you establish or your friend who you already know. And half of what we amateurs do is get on the air and say, what are you using? I'm using a such and such, and boy, it works like a charm. I used to use a so-and-so, and I hated it. And I sold it. Sold it to a guy who just loved that rig, and we're both happy. Well, it had a bunch of glitches, and I just put it in the corner and forgot about it and went and got another one. And should I buy a brand new rig or should I buy a used one on the flea market? You can save a lot of money with used equipment. And when you have access to a guy like Andy, WA2CDL, who can fix anything, even if it's been bounced down a flight of stairs and the front panel is dented, 90-some-odd% of the time, Andy can get that rig back on the air for you. So it doesn't have to be pretty. It doesn't have to be less than 1 year old. It doesn't have to have all the horns and whistles. The rig you're listening to now is the Kenwood TS-711, 1985 vintage. It's an oldie but goodie. It's a tank. It keeps on running. It keeps on cooking. I love the thing. K2KEY, who uses Collins equipment, is even older. K2RIW.
Then do we owe with Collins?
Another man with Collins coming in, and Collins an aficionado also, I think. Okay, well, about ready to lose the repeater, so I'm going to say goodnight. Yes, I can go on and on with this. I know I've got a kid, they sent me some testimonials on one of these verticals that it outperforms the movies, the people that are signing off on these testimonials on these antennas. I don't know what their relationship was to the company, but very impressive, okay? how much they were compensated, I have no idea, so I'm not even going to make any more of a statement about any of these antennas. Whatever works for you, that's the bottom line. 73 is all. We'll try to do it again next week. Take care, everybody, and have a great week. This is K2KEY. Go ahead, take any final words.
Yep. You guys have just wasted 4 hours of your life listening to Mel and Dick and Rich and Paul and Glenn and Jack and so on. Listen to all these guys on TechNet number 1185 of the series of TechNets that began in September of 1982. With a little luck, we'll all be back next week. We'll help each other with more opinions and a little bit of facts and a little bit of fun on this crazy hobby. 73-year-old, be kind to each other. And there's 26 kinds of ham radio. Think about trying one of the other kinds. Bye-bye for now. K2RIW Clear. Oh.